And welcome back to the Curbsiders. Tonight, I am with my co-host, Dr. Sean Cohen and Dr. Paul Williams. How are you guys doing on this wonderful Tuesday evening? Oh my gosh, it's Tuesday.
What day is it? I totally thought it was Tuesday until you called yourself
out. You
said
with confidence. I was convinced it was Tuesday for a hot
minute. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, it is Tuesday. But I'm good.
Well, the good news is that, you know, this was recorded prior to whatever today's date is. So whatever it may be, welcome. And we are thrilled to have you here. Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our new mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan. And on tonight's episode, we will discuss medications for alcohol use disorder with Dr. Alyssa Peterkin. But before we get started with that, Paul, will you please tell the audience what we do on this show?
Sure. Happy to. Thanks for the chance, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of medical educators. A reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is go there, log in, and create an account.
And I want to give a special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about their organization at their website, acam.org.
We have an intoxicating episode. No laughs. Okay. With our guest, Dr. Alyssa Peterkin. She's an internist and addiction medicine specialist who works at a hospitalist at one of the largest safety net hospitals in New England and serves as an associate program director for their addiction medicine fellowship. A plug for addiction medicine fellowships. Go do one. It's awesome. She also provides care for people with substance use disorders at a low barrier bridge clinic. She is very enthusiastic about teaching anyone who wants to learn about addiction and how to care for people with substance use disorders. And in this episode, she teaches us about how prevalent alcohol use disorder is, and yet how unlikely it is to be treated, how effective and easy it is to prescribe meds for alcohol use disorder, and that goals for treating alcohol use disorder aren't just abstinence. Drinking reduction is also evidence-based and incredibly effective.
And, you know, you shouldn't sell yourself short with that punch on, you know, you tried to slip it in, but
yeah,
but
I wasn't prepared for it. It was part of the issue. And then the other issue is it was a pun. So it was really a twofold problem for me.
I'm practicing my dad jokes. I've only been a dad for a little while, so I still need practice.
Don't worry. We'll get you there. You heard that, listeners. Every episode Sean's on, you can expect a dad joke.
Now I have to live up to that. So.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Hey, Alyssa, thanks for coming on the show. Why don't we just take a moment to ask you a couple of rapid-fire questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So can you please give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
A one-liner to describe myself? I guess I would say I am an internist, hospitalist, plant enthusiast. Over the last couple of years, I've really gotten into houseplants.
I think that's a good hobby to have over the last couple of years, I think. Do you have how did it start? Like, was it just like...
So I guess when I started residency, I guess it was my first time having my own apartment, and my mom got me a plant. I didn't really care too much about it. But then I guess as the pandemic went on, I just started to buy more plants, and I try to buy the ones that won't die. So I really look into it, I'm like, all right, I guess if I forget to water it, it'll be okay. But I've gotten to the next level. Like, if gnats start to, like, I have looked up all the different, like, remedies for gnats, and I've taken it to a whole nother level. If any of my friends are like, I'm having issues with my plants, I'm like, what's going on? How can I help?
That had felt like a really lovely hobby that I had actually thought about as well, until one time my cat, I found sort of just face deep in a lily, and I did not realize at the time that they are deeply toxic to cats. And so, you know, cut to $4,000 later and me asking questions like, is there cat dialysis? Question mark. And after that, I just don't have houseplants. The cat is fine, by the way, but it turned out
good.
To be a potentially expensive hobby that I can pursue. But I always admire other people who are able to keep it going.
And now you have to tell us, Paul, is there cat dialysis?
They refuse to answer the question. They're like, well.
That's a question for later. We're not there yet.
This is the curse of knowing too much. I probably should not have even asked the question. But yeah, the cat is happily fine.
A question I have for you, Alyssa, is I feel like a lot of, and if you're okay answering, but a lot of people's kind of journey to addiction med is pretty unique. Is there, like, what wound you up there?
So I would say I sort of got interested in addiction medicine when I was a fourth year in medical school. I was between becoming an internist and an ED doc, so I spent a lot of time in the emergency room. I saw a lot of people coming in, like drug affected or even, you know, requiring Narcan. And then I did a rotation at a sort of like a inpatient rehab setting, and I really liked the people that I was working with, and I was like, oh, this could be something. And then I got to residency. And I realized I didn't know how to take care of people with substance use disorder. Like, my program was like, yeah, we got a lot of addiction. I was like, oh, that's great. But then I was like, you guys aren't really doing anything about it. That's not great. And I did an away rotation at the institution I work at now. And I was like, wow, these people are doing such great things. They're so passionate. Like, I was able to see, you know, change. I'm probably one of the few people that went back a second time for this addiction rotation. So I guess, yeah, it's sort of been a journey starting in medical school. Got really, really excited in residency when I saw what could be done to help people with substance use disorder. And then I went back to my institution. I tried to make change with an alcohol project, actually. And I just sort of, I took things from there.
It's a great pitch for the need for education on treating addiction. So I'm glad you're here with us today.
Yes, and I hope there will be other residents and med students and other interprofessional folks listening that will feel just as passionate after they listen to this episode. So with that, you know, why don't we actually just jump into our case? Sean, do you mind sort of kicking us off and telling us about the case we're going to discuss today from Cashlack Memorial?
I'd love to. So we're going to talk about Miss J, and she's a 56-year-old woman who presents to your clinic after having a recent hospitalization for alcohol withdrawal. Her sister brought her in because she's just really concerned. She has a really long history of alcohol use and hypertension and diabetes, and she's just worried that her sister is just going to go back to drinking and wants to get her some help. She shares that she knows she's been on some medications before, but doesn't really know what they are and is hoping that we can do what we can to just help. And so I think I always think about the first step is how do you, when a patient presents to you and or with family member, when they come in and they say, I think I have a problem with alcohol, how do you kind of figure out, is this an alcohol use disorder? Is this just unhealthy alcohol use? Or is this kind of even lower down, like just routine alcohol use?
So I guess I start off by getting a drinking history, you can call it. So how much are you drinking in one setting, you know, in a week? And just to get an idea of someone's total alcohol intake. And then from there, you know, it'll give me a clue into if they have an unhealthy alcohol use consumption pattern versus an actual use disorder. One of the easier screening tools that I really like is the single item screening question. So, you know, for a female bodied person, having four or more drinks in one setting, or for a male bodied person, having five or more. So right off the bat, if someone answers, you know, at least once in the past year, they've, you know, met that criteria, I would say they have unhealthy alcohol use. And then sometimes, depending on the setting, I might go through the DSM-5 criteria, which is what we actually use to make the diagnosis of alcohol use disorder. And there are 11 criteria in total. And it's a criteria that's not only used to diagnose alcohol use disorder, but can also be used for any substance use disorder. But based on that, you know, someone can have a mild, moderate, or severe use disorder. So those are, I would say, some of my go-to questionnaires that I use or diagnostic criteria. But there are some other ones out there, like the audit and the audit C. But I would say the audit is much more lengthy. It's 10 questions. And I guess I can't forget about the CAGE questionnaire. I feel like that was like, probably recite that in my sleep, you know, like when you're in medical school, you're doing your ASCEs, they like I had a little like green card, I think it was, and it had all the questions on there. And I didn't really know what I was doing, but I knew the questions. And I still know them now.
Yeah, I still remember eye-opener is seared into my memory forever, I think.
Before I knew what an eye-opener was.
And Alyssa, I wanted to ask, you know, a lot of these, especially like the single item screening question, sort of rely on quantification of alcohol use to actually sort of point you in the right direction. So I'm wondering if you would mind sort of talking me through sort of your approach to figure out like how many drinks patients are actually taking, because I feel like that's pretty variable and patients may define a drink differently than perhaps we do.
Yes, because I mean, I don't know how many people are actually measuring the ounces, you know, like how much they might just say, I had a bottle of wine. And so you have to sort of think how many drinks are actually in a bottle of wine. And I kind of go based on that because I know just, I guess, from life experience, like if you go to a party, like, and someone might be pouring you a drink, they could be putting more than one alcohol in there. You're not sure how much is going in there. So it's really hard to say. And I think as people who drink alcohol in this country, we don't learn what a standard drink is. We just learn what alcohol is, I guess. So it's a little bit tricky. But I would say for the most part, most of my patients will sort of say glasses. So you could maybe say like how big of a glass, that type of thing might be a way to go if someone is drinking wine. If they're drinking, you know, a mixed drink, like I think that's important too, because as the name implies, it's going to have more than one type of alcohol. So we can already assume like if, I don't know, they had like a Long Island, there's maybe like actually four drinks in that one drink. So just keeping that in mind.
Yeah, no, oftentimes my patients will tell me they don't drink alcohol, just beer. So like, I think it is sometimes helpful just to sort of be very specific in terms of what patients are actually drinking. Like, no alcohol, just beer. And you're like, all right, then we need to go back and maybe I have to ask some more questions again.
I do have a cheat sheet, though. It has different types of alcohol on there, and it helps, you know, it actually even has like a party cup, and it tells you kind of how much along the lines actually equals a standard drink. So that's helpful. I think it's a sort of a good tool to have in clinic, a good visual tool for patients.
This is the card that we all needed with us during our clinic visits. So we'll make a link if you don't mind sharing that with us. We can put it in the show notes for folks to access.
For sure.
So it sounds like overall you kind of right at the beginning, you're taking like almost a two-step approach of first like figuring out if they have unhealthy alcohol use using that one question screener and then talking through what an actual drink is. And then if they do have unhealthy alcohol use, you're taking that next step of trying to determine if they meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder.
Yes. And I guess the one thing I would say is, you know, sometimes that information comes up in the initial history. So I don't have to, I guess, bore the patients or, you know, ask them all 11 questions or, you know, go through all 11 criteria all over again. But if they're ones that I'm not totally sure whether or not they meet, then I will, you know, explicitly ask those criteria.
And we learn a little bit more about Miss J, that they have a long history of alcohol use and that she has been drinking daily since the age of 18. And right now, she actually can't remember any significant period of not using alcohol other than the time she's been in the hospital for alcohol withdrawal. So you determine that Miss J meets the DSM-5 criteria for a moderate alcohol use disorder, and you plan to use the rest of your visit to discuss treatment options. My first question to you is that patients present to us in all different stages of readiness to make a change with different goals, whether that may be abstinence or just cutting back. Do you have an approach to discussing with patients what their goals are in regarding their substance use?
So sort of as you mentioned, you know, I ask the patient, like, what do you want to do here? What are your goals around drinking? Do you want to cut down? How much do you think you want to cut down and what time frame? Or do you want to stop drinking altogether? Or do you want to do both over time? So I try to take more of a patient-centered approach and meet patients where they're at, because I think, you know, I realize we all have bad habits or unhealthy behaviors, and easier said than done to just, you know, one day wake up and say, I'm not going to do this. And I just, you know, want patients to, you know, understand that I know, I realize that they're human. I'm human too. I'm not a super person where I can just be good all the time, do what's right. You know, I go to the doctor too. So that's sort of the approach that I take. And for folks who are really sort of pre-comp, you know, you don't know where they are in their stage of change, I do use some of the, you know, principles of motivational interviewing. So what do you like about drinking? What do you like less? Have you ever thought about how your alcohol use might be impacting your health? And I guess I meet a lot of patients in the hospital, so they might have an idea what's going on. So it's a little bit of a different scenario, but it's still helpful for them to tell you in their own words what they think might be going on. It might not have happened in the, you know, related to this hospitalization, but there could have been other things that are happening in their life that are related to their alcohol use.
And I think that brings up, like, I mean, the fact that you work in the hospital and address this in the hospital is like so critically important, right? Is like, I mean, this Our Lady, Miss J, she came in for alcohol withdrawal. That while this clinic visit is an awesome time to address this stuff, that hospitalization would have also been an awesome time to address this stuff and talk about what we're going to talk about with her too. And so just a quick plug for addressing things in the hospital.
Yes.
I will say in the primary care setting, like I will sometimes encounter patients who get the sense that they feel like they've sort of lost control of their alcohol use and they're concerned about it, but then also very much view it as an issue of willpower. Like, oh, I just need to kind of get my act together is sort of a phrase that I hear very often, and don't really think about this in terms of a diagnosis that has treatments or so. I guess what I'm wondering is how do you frame this discussion when you're having this conversation with patients? Like when you talk about alcohol use disorder with patients, how do you explain it to them? Period, I guess, end of sentence.
Okay. So I guess that's an interesting way to say it. I don't think I haven't had anyone say to me, you know, what is it alcohol? Like, what is this alcohol use disorder? What does this mean? But I sort of frame, I guess, any addiction, it's a chronic disease. And, you know, there are a lot of different components that go into why someone may choose to use alcohol or any other substances. And I don't think it's not a moral failing. It's, you know, not a choice totally. There are genetic components, there's psychosocial stressors. So there are a lot of things that play into why someone might have uncontrolled use, cravings, despite negative consequences, which are some of the big C's I say when I think about an addiction. And so I talk to them along those lines. And for someone who says, oh, I know I can just stop, I can do that, I was like, that's great. You know, I may not totally know you yet, so maybe that is possible, right? But I say I'm a planner, right? I like to have a plan A, a plan B, and maybe a plan C. So if your plan A doesn't work, let's try to think about what the next steps might be. Because I think it's easy to say, oh, I can do it, and then we're going to end the conversation. But that's not gonna work with me. I want us to really to come up with some concrete goals here. Like, I had a patient in clinic, and this week he actually started, like, writing stuff down in a notebook. And I was like, I was so proud. I was like, this is great. This is so great.
I want to give all my patients little notebooks now and like possibly some stickers too. Like, ah, yes, let's work on these goals. And on that note, you know, our patient, they are interested in hearing more about treatment options. So how do you present the different treatment options for alcohol use disorder?
So I first start off with the FDA approved medication. So naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram. And I talk about them actually in that order. I start with naltrexone because I feel like it is first line, and in my eyes, it's more commonly used by a lot of my patients. And so I talk about how it works, which is very important because it is an opioid receptor antagonist. So I say that one because if, you know, someone needs opioids in the future for some reason, I want them to understand how that medication might play a role. So I kind of lay that off up front. I let them know how the medication will be helpful. So I say, you know, the data shows that it reduces heavy drinking and heavy drinking days. And, you know, this is just a marker that we can check in on later on. And I do talk about some of the adverse reactions or side effects. So headaches, some I guess fatigue, and the big one is a sort of like dysphoria. But the way I frame that is that, you know, the medicine is blocking the endogenous opioids that used to, you know, bind to your receptors when you drank alcohol. Now that's not going to happen because this medicine is working in that way. So I talk about that and say mostly it's a once a day medication. I think that's important too. Like, you only have to take it once a day. It comes in an extended release formulation where you can get an injection once a month. So those are some of the big points that I hit on with naltrexone. And then I move on to a Camprasate. And so, you know, again, this would be for someone who likely may not be a candidate for naltrexone. So if they have pretty significant liver impairment, or there's someone who is taking opioids, then that would be an option. But I also say, like, I probably myself would have trouble taking a medicine three times a day. This is a three times a day medicine. What do you think about that? So again, a lot of it is like how successful I think patients will be in actually adhering to the medication administration process as part of what I tell them. And then also saying, you know, are you a candidate for the medicine? So thinking about someone's creatinine clearance. So letting them, again, know that, you know, this is not something you have to keep an eye on, but we will. And if you are at risk for having a change in your creatinine clearance, we might have to change the dose. So we can do the full dose, but if your creatinine clearance drops, you know, below 50 mLs per, I mean, I don't give them those numbers, but those would, you know, that's what I'm sort of thinking in my head. Then I would reduce the dose. And then if, you know, it drops below 30, we have to stop it. So I just say, we'll keep an eye on this number. And, you know, if things change, we might have to change your dose. And then when I talk about disulfiram, I also kind of put it in its own bucket. Like, if you drink, this will make you sick. The other two medicines will not. I think that's a big concern. A lot of people have maybe heard about the general idea of disulfiram, so to speak. They're like, oh, there's something if you drink it make you sick. And I'm like, yeah, it's that medicine. But I also say, like, any amount of alcohol. So, like, you have a dessert, it has alcohol in there, the mouthwash, all these things. Because I don't want patients to be surprised, because I wouldn't want to be surprised. So I guess the big take home is what I think about medicines for alcohol use disorder. So starting with the FDA approved, are there any absolute contraindications for these medicines? So, you know, if someone had hepatitis and their LFTs were elevated, or they had decompensated cirrhosis, or they were taking opioids, then I would say naltrexone is sort of off the table. And then a Camprasate would be the option. If there's someone who's really motivated and they want disulfiram, and I don't think, you know, I worry about someone who has pretty compromised cardiac function, I wouldn't want to put, you know, that type of, you know, potential reaction stress on their heart. So I would say maybe, you know, this exists, but I don't, you know, I would not recommend it. And also just thinking about who might be around to make sure the patient actually takes the medicine, because if you don't take it, it won't work. That's also something I say off front. So I try to be as transparent with what we're kind of looking for with these meds, what they will do. Yeah, and I guess that's sort of my spiel.
Can I get just a little bit granular with naltrexone for just a hot minute? I would love to know how you initiate, you know, because I know that some of the side effects are fairly gnarly. And I've heard some people sort of start at lower doses and then up titrate after 3 days. So I guess that's my first question. And then I'll save my second one until I have to answer that one, I guess.
Yes. So unless someone has already, you know, tried naltrexone at another point in their life and did well, meaning they didn't have any adverse reactions, I started half the dose. So 25 milligrams for a couple days and increase it after 3 days to the full dose. Other ways to sort of get around maybe some of the side effects I forgot to mention earlier, there can be some dizziness, is maybe taking it at nighttime, or if you're having an upset stomach, making sure you're taking it with food. So those are some of the ways to help with the side effects.
Great. Thank you. And then the liver disease component is a part, I think, that makes a lot of prescribers particularly nervous. So I'm just sort of wondering, what is your threshold to say, okay, this is not the person for naltrexone? Because it seems like there's been some more recent safety data that it seems like it's fairly safe even in patients with cirrhosis. But I guess sort of what's your level of comfort for hepatic dysfunction before you say, okay, this is not the medication for you?
Okay, so thinking about maybe like acute situations. So if someone is having hepatitis or LFTs are 5 times the upper limit of normal, I wouldn't start the medicine. And I would want to make sure that the LFTs are downtrending before starting it, and then just keep a close eye. And I would say this would probably be someone I might be seeing in the hospital. So I have the liberty of daily labs, or even more frequent than that if I wanted to. And then for someone who has cirrhosis, I say, you know, if someone keeps drinking, their liver function is only going to get worse. And so if we can give them a medicine to help reduce their drinking, that will likely prevent the progression of their liver disease. But that being said, if someone has decompensated cirrhosis, so they're having hepatic encephalopathy, I would not start the medicine in that case and think about other options, whether it is one of the other FDA approved medicines or one of the off label medicines.
You know, throw out a pitch for, there is like some recent guidance that came out from the providers, PCSS, I never remember what it stands for, but that's some rec saying that if you're seeing someone in the clinic and you don't really have time to get LFTs and they have an alcohol use disorder, that you can still start naltrexone as long as they don't have overt signs of decompensated cirrhosis. Like, that shouldn't stop you from starting the medications for people, because we know these meds work, are really helpful, and not drinking is much better for your liver than these.
Yeah, the typical patient that I'll see in clinic with just slightly elevated LFTs that I have from 2 years ago, and I'm not seeing any jaundice, generally I'll start it right away in clinic. And I'm curious, in your practice, Alyssa, do you ever go above 50 milligrams? Or you just sort of say, hey, once we hit 50, we'll keep you at that dose?
I personally have not gone above 50, but I have heard some folks who have, you know, done 100 milligrams daily, and that seems to work well. I guess, if we think back to when naltrexone first came on the market, there was that concern for hepatotoxicity, and really the studies were showing that was at higher doses. So that's the only caveat that I have. You know, I am all for naltrexone for sure, and whatever we can do to help support folks. But, you know, if we are going with higher doses, we just want to make sure that we're not going to be doing any harm.
And you alluded to this earlier. You said that there were a couple of off-label medications that you possibly could use for alcohol use disorder. Could you tell us a little bit more about those?
Sure. So those medicines primarily are topiramate and gabapentin. And so those work sort of by modulating the GABA system. I would say I don't use them as often. Topiramate, I sort of think about also sometimes, it is also an off-label medicine for cocaine craving. So if someone also is using alcohol and cocaine, which is not an uncommon thing, that might be a treatment to consider. You start at a lower dose, so you can start anywhere between 25 and 50 milligrams and up titrate weekly by increments of 25 and 50 to get to a total daily dose of about 300 milligrams a day. And that's what the studies have shown has had, you know, the most benefit in reducing heavy drinking. But that being said, topiramate has a lot of adverse reactions. So really thinking about your patient, what maybe co-occurring conditions might have, that person might have, or, you know, be at risk for. And, you know, because it is off-label, I want to be upfront and be like, look, there are, you know, these are some of the more common adverse reactions, and also just letting the patient know what to look out for. So I think that's sort of the one challenge with topiramate. I mean, we use it for a lot of things, but it has a lot of side effects. And then the other medicine is gabapentin, which there have been, you know, several studies that have been done over, and I'm going to say last couple of years, but there have been a lot of studies on gabapentin looking at different dosages. And I think that's another option too, if your patient is not a candidate for one of the off-label medicines. But I can't speak for sort of what's going on in the rest of the country, but in, you know, where I practice, gabapentin is pretty heavily used, not for non-prescribed purposes. And so thinking about that is the patient, I would hope the patient is going to take it, but, you know, thinking about there is that potential for, you know, diversion or things like that. And also I sort of the other issue is with sedation. And I guess lastly, like, you know, renal function, right? I sound like I'm a nephrologist talking about renal function, you know, all night. But basically, you know, someone could develop toxicity from the medicine if their, you know, kidney function is compromised. So again, thinking about with these off-label medicines, what your patient might also be at risk for and what is the risk-benefit discussion you want to think about, you know, before you start the medicine as a person prescribing it, but also with the patient who will be taking it.
Yeah, I feel like I have a similar approach to you of like, I like naltrexone first, if there's like a very clear contraindication or someone's on opioids, decompensated cirrhosis, maybe a camprasate if they really want to take six pills a day, which no one really wants to take six pills a day. If they're like, say, like, I want something that's going to make me sick if I drink, obviously disulfiram. And then otherwise you go to these non-FDAs. I was honestly pretty surprised when like the new VA guidelines came out that like put topiramate as co-first line. And I was just like, I never even realized the data. I like never prescribe it, to be honest. And so I didn't realize the data was so strong for it. But I agree. I feel like I've never been able to really titrate people up to a dose high enough for it to become effective. But
I have the same experience. I've never been able to get somebody up, quite frankly, to a high enough topiramate dose. Everybody wants to stop because of the adverse effects that they have. I will say it's not uncommon that I'll actually use two of these medications together, particularly the naltrexone and gabapentin combination in my own practice. So I have a lot of patients who really their goal is more so for moderation, and both naltrexone and gabapentin have some evidence to sort of help decrease heavy drinking days. So if I start somebody on naltrexone and maybe they cut back, but they aren't quite meeting their goal, they're telling me that they're having possibly a lot of anxiety, you know, trouble sleeping, that is a time where I'll reach for both of them and have had like some decent luck. I'm curious, does anybody else here use these medications in combination?
I do, but I also trained at the exact same fellowship as you, so I don't know if that's too shocking. But yeah, definitely, I agree. I feel like for people that want to moderate, I mean, the data for gabapentin is more in people that have withdrawal symptoms too, and there's some data that gabapentin treats withdrawal, so it's probably some interaction there. But I've definitely used naltrexone and gabapentin particularly together, and I mean, it seems like it works for some people, but everything seems like it works for some people, so...
I feel like it's another, you know, tool to have in your toolbox. And again, if it's something we can do to help get patients closer to the goal, which in this case sounds like it was, you know, moderation of drinking rather than abstinence, why not? And, you know, if it's not so much a concern about what might be happening with the gabapentin after you prescribe it, then I don't see a problem with that. But I know there's a lot of concern with gabapentin where I practice. So I keep that in mind.
I feel like in the primary care world, we desperately want gabapentin to work because it's a medication we actually have familiarity with and comfort with, as opposed to, say, like an naltrexone or a camprasate, even though I think those obviously have better data and are probably as safe, if not safer, to some extent. I was going to ask, are there any secondary features that for which you might reach for one medication over another? I know you mentioned sort of contraindications, but like for specifically, I'm thinking about insomnia. I see with early abstinence from alcohol as being a really bothersome feature. So in that case, I may reach more for a gabapentin, or if I remember right, I think even a camprasate has some data for insomnia associated for sort of early abstinence too. Is there any other sort of things that run along or any other considerations when you're choosing one medication over another? And no is also an okay answer too, by the way.
I guess other than, you know, if there's like a co-occurring condition, I guess the other thing for which we haven't totally mentioned, but naltrexone, if someone has opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder, that could also be a potential option if they're not, you know, taking buprenorphine or methadone. So that's another time, I guess, where I'm making a decision. But in terms of, you know, if someone is having insomnia, I give my sort of spiel about, you know, when we use substances, our brain is really dysregulated and it takes a long time for us to reset. And I guess I actually go to a different, you know, medicine rather than using something that might have added benefit. But I also keep in mind that oftentimes no medicine is going to totally help someone's insomnia, which really sucks, right? Because who doesn't want to be able to sleep?
Yeah, and I'll say the only co-occurring thing that I think of is like alcohol-induced neuropathy. Obviously, like all neuropathies, we think of gabapentin, and so kind of the same. But
so, Alyssa, you've just given us a ton of great tools to use, and the toolkits really help our patients with alcohol use disorder. And I'm curious, just how effective are these medications?
I would say they're pretty effective. Again, so the for looking at naltrexone and what the evidence shows in reducing heavy drinking and thinking about the number needed to treat, which is fairly low. In some studies, it's as low as like 10. Some studies maybe a little bit higher, around the order of 20, but I still feel like that's generally pretty low. And then, so there's naltrexone, and then thinking about acamprosate, where it's more so the abstinence focus. So the risk reduction isn't amazing. I'm not going to, you know, kind of upplay that. But again, you know, the bigger picture is that I feel like we have all of these meds and they're so underutilized. You know, like I think it's on the order of like maybe 1.2% of people who have an alcohol use disorder and could benefit from meds actually get medications. And I think that's like pretty astounding, because if you compare that to, you know, something else like diabetes or, you know, hypertension, it's a totally different ball game. And then, yeah, and I would say, I guess the number needed to treat for acamprosate is a little bit higher than naltrexone. But again, I think it's still under the 20 mark number. And then if we look at gabapentin, again, gabapentin and topiramate, those are both, their evidence is really for reducing heavy drinking and heavy drinking days. And again, a lot of the studies have been able to replicate those results, you know, and as mentioned before, they can be used, at least gabapentin can also be used in conjunction for people who are having more so mild alcohol withdrawal symptoms. So you can start it, you know, when they're having withdrawal and continue it as sort of a bridge to treatment.
And I think it's worth, I love using number needed to treat because it gives you like this tangible number of like how many people you need to have a positive outcome. But I love couching it in like meds we use all the time compared to like this med we never use, right? We 1% of people get these meds. We only have to treat 8 people to have a positive outcome. Like that's similar to SSRIs, which we prescribe all the time. And that's loads better than like statins for primary prevention. So like these are like tools in all of our like PCP toolboxes that we can use to really have a big impact on patients and really help people.
And after you start these medications, and I realize this might vary by what you choose, what does follow-up look like for these patients? How soon should you see them back? How often? And what kind of things are you assessing and reassessing?
So, you know, I think, you know, the big thing is you want to let the patient know that you're there to support them and kind of on their own terms, how frequently you want to see them. But I would say within the month, you should check in on them and see what else, you know, if there's someone who only wants to use medications for alcohol use disorder, that's fine. But if they're interested in other, you know, psychosocial supports, whether it's like groups, individual counseling, make sure some of those other things have also been set in place too. So I would say having a pretty close follow-up, especially when you are starting the meds and someone is just sort of getting oriented to treatment, because there might be some challenges navigating this recovery process. So again, just being available to the patient for those purposes. And if you're thinking about more in the lines of like monitoring labs, it's based for me sort of on someone's risk factors, right? So if someone, if someone has heart failure and they're on Lasix and you know that they might be at risk for developing acute kidney injury because that has happened before, and you've started them on acamprosate, you might just want to, you know, check in within the first couple weeks, especially, you know, if you have that sort of other concern, given the whole clinical picture. And then if you're thinking about maybe LFTs, I know initial with naltrexone, there can be sort of a transient increase in LFTs when it's first initiated, but that usually self-resolves, and it's not for every patient. It's only for a handful. So if you kind of catch that on routine labs and you want to make sure that's downtrending, but I don't typically kind of say like, oh, you need to come in a Q4 weeks for labs, you know, just to make sure.
I think things that always come up are like some people come in and say, well, I started drinking again, so I stopped my meds. Is that, Is that like something that we should be telling them to do or not to do, like in the case of naltrexone or any of the other meds we were talking about? Obviously, disulfiram, they should stop if they're going to drink. But.
Right. So I guess thinking back to, again, what is the patient's goal, right? So a lot of times people are like, oh, the medicine didn't work for me. And I'm like, what does that really mean? And they could say, oh, I still drink. And I'll say, well, did you drink less? Did you drink the same amount? Like, what really changed with your drinking behavior? If someone is returned to use, like if now, you know, if they took a medicine and they were actually able to stop drinking, I would say that's great. And then thinking about what might have caused them to return to use. Was it the medication? Like, you know, what else might be going on? But I wouldn't say like, oh, you've started drinking again, you should stop the medicine. I would say continue, because there's likely going to be some benefit. And we can think about other ways that we can help, you know, get you back on track.
Another thing that comes up is patients want to know, how long do I have to be on this medication? Because, you know, every person in the history of time is trying to take less medication.
And I say, as long as you need to be. Hopefully by then we've gotten to know each other really well and say, hey, why were you drinking in the first place, right? You know, if there was something else that was going on in your life and that has not been sorted out or sort of addressed, and the medicine was helping you and you take away sort of the one thing that was working for you, how, you know, we want you to be successful. So I say, let's, you know, if someone, if on the other hand, someone is, you know, kind of addressed all those other things that might be going on, they're feeling more stable in their recovery, then, you know, we can give, you know, the medicine a break. But also at the end of the day, it's sort of up to them, right? This is, they're the ones that have to take the medicine. I'm not there. It's not me. And I will support them in that decision and say, well, this is my medical opinion. But if this is what you want to do, that is okay too. I'm not upset with you. I'm here for you. If it doesn't work out the way you wanted it to, let's meet again. Or not say let's meet again. We are going to meet again regardless. And, you know, just check in and see what the next steps will be.
Earlier, you alluded to this as well, that a lot of our patients use psychosocial interventions. They have an individual therapist, they go to IOP, they are in some group setting. And if you're listening, we're going to actually do an entire episode on psychosocial interventions. Since we're really focused on alcohol use disorder, a lot of patients ask me about AA. That comes up quite a bit in my office. So I'm curious, like, what's your spiel to patients if they're thinking about AA? How do you counsel them? And how do you see it may fit or not fit with a patient's care plan?
So if they're interested, I say check it out. The way I learned it in training was like AA is sort of like dating, right? You kind of have to try a couple out, see what works, right? There are different themes to the meetings. You know, depending on where you go, there might be a different group or demographic of people. So you just got to try a couple of them out. If, you know, the first one, if you're lucky, maybe it'll be a good fit. But oftentimes that might not be the case. So I just encourage them, you know, sort of not to give up if this is something they are sort of interested in and, you know, thinking about going through the steps and then, you know, the idea of potentially having sponsorship and all the other, you know, aspects of AA. But I think most importantly, I just say, you know, with recovery, it takes time. And, you know, this is trying these different groups is part of the process. But that being said, if they do go to, you know, a couple and it really isn't a fit, then we can think about maybe some other groups that are available that, you know, might be a better fit.
This is a big question. This might be its own episode, so we can just sort of blow it off if this doesn't work out. But I'm wondering, you know, we know that there is a lot of concomitant mood disorder with alcohol use disorder. I'm just sort of wondering what your approach is to sort of assessing for that, or, you know, your initial steps towards management, if you have any.
Right. So I guess probably before my time, a lot of people would say like, oh, we got to wait for someone to abstain from substances to figure out if, like, you know, what's going on. But we know that a lot of our patients have co-occurring conditions. So waiting them to abstain might not be possible, but, you know, they need this, they need help. They need, you know, something. And so whether it's, I sort of kind of figure out sort of where they're at in terms of their mental health, if they want to see a therapist, see a psychiatrist. You know, within our care setting, we also have an addiction psychiatry treatment program. So, you know, for folks who sort of, you know, have those needs, we can, you know, send them there and they can get those needs met. But I do agree, it's important to address them because sort of as I mentioned earlier, like substance use and addiction, it's complicated, but there are a lot of factors that play a role. And so working to address all of them is going to be most helpful to the patient.
Yeah, there's this, that's perfect. There's this little study that I love that actually had patients with comorbid alcohol use disorder and depression, and they randomized those patients to either sertraline, naltrexone, or both, or neither. And not surprisingly, the patients were treated both the ones who ended up drinking less alcohol as well. So like it's probably in the journal of what you would expect to happen. But it was just a nice little study that actually sort of emphasized the importance of kind of dealing with all those things and not just the one thing. So I love that answer.
Yeah, can I publish in that journal?
I need to get a copy.
It's actually
of that.
One of those things we have to pay to publish in it, but we're happy to have you.
We're lucky, you know, Miss J has actually decided to try naltrexone, and you guys have determined together that her goal is really just to reduce her alcohol intake, but right now she's really not interested in abstinence. So how do you talk to your patients about harm reduction for alcohol use disorder?
So I guess thinking about what is sort of their drinking scenario situation, you know, are they someone, you know, are they going out with friends every night? You know, are they having shots? So things like that. So avoiding shots, you know, making sure you're eating when you are drinking, staying hydrated. Those are some of the more common ones for people who like to be on social media while they are, you know, drinking. Like maybe that's not a good idea. Like if things went wrong in the past, let's see how we can make them right in the future. And so again, what are the baby behaviors that are happening that are, you know, putting patients at risk? So I really just kind of listen to them and kind of go through some of the scenarios and see what would be most helpful. Another thing that I learned about recently is that, you know, carbonated beverages the alcohol is absorbed more quickly compared to non-carbonated. So, you know, you will get drunk faster. So, you know, thinking about how can we kind of get you through the night safely. And again, just thinking about what you're actually drinking, you know, who you're drinking with. Is there someone who can help cut you off? Are you having trouble keeping track of how much you're drinking? So, you know, sometimes if you want to, like, if you're drinking beers and you have the bottle caps, like saving those, then you actually know how much you drink because you might not remember. And avoid sort of, you know, topping up, like if you drink all of your drink rather than sort of like, oh, I'm halfway there and filling it up, because then you sort of lose track again of how much you're drinking. So those are some of the things I talk to patients about, but it sort of depends on the patient and what their drinking behaviors and situations are like.
Yeah, I love that idea of like, I mean, as with everything, we should be personalizing it for the situations people are in, right? And just a plug for, I always download this one page sheet on like harm reduction for alcohol use, which I didn't know was a thing really. I mean, it like makes sense as a thing, but I didn't know there was like a name for it until becoming a fellow. But there's a one page sheet from, I think, the University of Washington that we can put in the show notes too, that has like a lot of these great tips and splits them up into kind of the different behaviors and things like that too.
It's just been a great episode. We want to thank you so much, Dr. Peterkin, for spending your evening with us. So while we are getting ready to wrap up, do you have any main take-home points for our listeners?
I would say remember that alcohol, the number of people who have alcohol use disorder is far outweighs the number of people have opioid use disorder. And I know we are in an overdose epidemic, but we can't forget about alcohol. It's super important. You know, if we looked at how many people had alcohol use disorder in 2019 and the number of people who had alcohol use disorder in 2020, the number has doubled, right? So like we really need to talk to our patients about their drinking and prescribe medications. They work and like you can do it.
I love that. It's like a little audience pep talk. Like, you can do it. We believe in you. You got this. You have all the tools you need. You can do it today. You're ready.
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to plug before we sign off?
Not that I can. I feel like that is my like main spiel about alcohol use disorder and alcohol. Just again, talk to patients about it. Don't be afraid. of the medicines. And talk to your patients about their goals, right? Don't just sort of put that like everyone needs to stop drinking, because that might not necessarily be what your patient wants. So again, just meeting patients where they're at and helping them meet their goals and being realistic that they might take time to achieve, right? No, someone can't and probably won't just stop drinking overnight, and we can't sort of expect them to, because we are real people and this is a real world, and that I've never seen that happen, in my expert opinion.
So this has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So subscribe, rate, and review the show at Apple Podcasts, or send us an email at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com to tell us what we did right and wrong.
A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as Dr. Zena Huxley-Riker, who has been our producer for this episode. Don't forget to check out ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Find their website at acaam.org to learn more about their organization.
And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is go there and create an account. And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams.
Until next time, I'm Sean Cohen.
And I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a good night.